This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is Solar for all the planet, and all the people. Please welcome our distinguished panel. Adam Branley, Vote Solar. Maribel Nzengu, how do I pronounce that, Maribel? Nzengu, thank you. Climate justice expert. And Erica Mackey, co-founder and CEO, Grid Alternatives. So I'm going to turn it over to Adam now for this wonderful program tonight. Thank you, Adam.
We're going to start by having each one of us introduce ourselves, talk a little bit about why we're here, why we're, what we've done, what we're doing, what gives us hope, what our motivations are. And then we're going to have a prompted discussion, back and forth, questions and answers, rather than a PowerPoint. And at the end, again, there will be that opportunity for audience questions that I hope will prove illuminating. So I'm actually going to just begin with a little bit more around Vote Solar and what we've done, and then I'll turn it over to you guys, and we'll go forward from there. So as I said, you know, Vote Solar, we were founded back in 2002. I was a co-founder. Our goal was to bring solar energy into the mainstream, really motivated principally myself by climate issues. Really recognized that solar had this awesome answer. It was a solution that we really needed, but it was really expensive at that time. And so for the past 15 years, really been focused going state by state, looking at the barriers to solar, looking at the inducements to going solar, and have changed policies around the country with the idea of building scale in order to bring down costs. And that strategy has really largely worked as it's been implemented, not just nationally, but globally. We're now at a situation here in California that you've got about over nearly 600,000 distributed generation solar installations throughout the state, generating nearly 4.5 gigawatts worth of solar. And then on the utility scale side, nearly 8 gigawatts of solar, a little more than 8 gigawatts of solar, sum total of which on sunny afternoons, the state is regularly powered around 30% solar, and really 10% of that, 10% of the state's power coming from rooftop small-scale solar installations. Think about that. We're looking at the sixth largest economy in the world running on what was once just a hippie daydream. And really, it's a tremendous achievement. And this you know, is something for me, solar really is democracy. The energy history of this country has been about giving monopolies the choice over what energy consumers get. Solar is a distributed technology or utility scale technology, but what it is that it's a technology, not a resource. And that fundamentally has broken this paradigm of having just utility monopolies being able to make that choice. So when I think of solar, I really think about democracy in energy decision making. As we make this transition, as solar's costs have come down, there's been a growing awareness, and a lot of leaders, including those that are on this podium with me right now, have really pressed, you know, is everybody benefiting from this transition? Can everybody access solar? Can everybody participate and benefit from this transition to renewable energy? And asking ourselves those hard questions, we really looked at, well, there's a lot of great success stories that I think I'd love to talk about more tonight. There are a lot of other barriers that are preventing that from happening. So we've now started a new program focused exclusively on ensuring that everybody can participate in this transition. So that's a little context from myself as to why I'm here, why I think this is important, and what we're trying to do about it. Again, 18 people around the country focused on, again, just trying to ensure that solar energy can grow to solve our climate and other problems as well. So with that, I'll turn it over to Maribel Nzengu, who is a honored guest. She's standing in for Vien Trong, who was previously scheduled to be here. Vien was with Power for All. She got caught up in D.C. There was a certain secretary that kept her a little bit too long. And so Mary Bell was graciously agreed to stand in. She has been a longtime climate warrior here in California and has some incredible stories to share as well. So with that, we'd love for you to give us some context.
Thank you, Adam. And again, my name is Mary Bell Nzegu. My perspective is through the law. I'm an attorney, and I've been practicing law in California since I graduated in about 2006. but I come to this issue of solar panels and solar energy basically through this construction of where are the benefits and where are the burdens in our society. When we talk about oil, the oil industry, that energy is produced somewhere. when the oil is combusted, the emissions go places, and this disproportionate impact is what we see across the country. That the United Church of Christ, back in 1983, produced this study on toxic waste and race, but I think the principle holds true for all forms of pollution, which is to say that race is a very strong indicator of where all the pollution is in society. It's actually even a stronger indicator than class or income. So, you know, environmental justice is really about the equitable distribution of both the burdens and the benefits in society. And, you know, we come at this from a really practical sense of, like, why are some people burdened? They are burdened because they lack power and they lack a seat at the table and they are not being consulted in the decisions that affect them, in the environmental decisions that affect them. So I began my work in the Central Valley of California, really helping to protect some of the rural communities down there from animal factories and other forms of pollution down there. And then in 2006, when California enacted our Climate Solutions Act, which is known as AB 32, I began to see some really strong correlations between climate justice overall and, you know, environmental justice that I had been working on. You know, when you talk about carbon emissions, they go into the air and they're not localized impacts. They affect the globe. But the emissions are not emitted in isolation. They come out with other harmful toxins such as particulate matter and NOx, and these things have local impacts and affect the local communities that live near these facilities and near these freeways. So essentially, I have worked my whole career to help the state of California figure out ways to avoid impacts on disadvantaged communities and also figure out ways to bring the benefits to these same communities and really give the people there a chance to become empowered, to engage the system, and really have a say in their future. So that's a little bit about me and why I do this work.
Thank you, Mary Bell. And then Erica Mackey.
Thanks. Again, Erica Mackey. I'm the CEO and one of two co-founders at Grid Alternatives. Grid Alternatives is a very practical nonprofit on the ground doing some of the work that we're all talking about here today. I mean, we have a strong vision that we can, as a country, make a transition to clean power. And we want to make sure that that is done in a way that everyone can benefit. And by everyone, we mean both everyone as consumers of solar and everyone as employees in that clean economy, if they so choose. And so all of our work is really about putting up blue panels
but it is so much more than the blue panels. So while we as an organization love solar and we look and feel like, you know, a nonprofit solar contractor, and we have construction staff that oversee installations, everything that we think about is how do we enable families to take their energy into their own hands? How do we enable folks to get the training and the hands-on experience to get a job, that first job or that promotion or that, you know, good green job to join the clean economy and put green not only on their rooftop, but back into their pockets and as a career move. So we are national in scope. We have 15 bricks and mortar offices across the country. We have a very substantial tribal program that works with about 30 tribes across the country. And all of our work feels similar in that it really is everyone coming together to make change one rooftop at a time. Or in the case of a ground-mounted system, you know, in rural Colorado, one panel at a time, one, you know, array at a time. And so you can kind of think of us as the nonprofit version of barn raising, where all of our climate leaders, which really the communities that we're talking about, when we talk about everyone here, you know, these are communities that are our climate leaders, are able to come together with their neighbors, with their cousin, with their son or their daughter who wants a job, and make solar power happen in their community.
I'm a huge admirer of everything that that you do. So thank you for sharing that. So now, with this context here, I would like to go to that questions and answers back and forth. And so I would just like to start with just your assessment, both of you. I'm going to let you figure out which one to go first, and then you can ask back. But just what are the barriers here? What problem do we need to fix? What problem are we trying to solve? So,
well, I think, you know, there's something that Maribel said where, you know, really in terms of you know, this do no harm, right? So much of environmental justice of the past has been, how do we stop doing bad stuff? How do we stop making it so low-income communities and communities of color are having a higher asthma rate than the national average because they're breathing traditional power? How do we stop polluting, you know, the river that flows through a rural community and people are drinking that water? How do we stop? How do we, you know, change that? And then we've moved to a place where it's like, okay, well, how do we stop that and how do we do some good stuff? And I would contend that we're at a juncture where we're starting to see we've done some good stuff, and we start to think through, how do we really intersect the issues of our time? How do we intersect climate change with a social justice movement? Mm-hmm. How do we think about the issues we're facing around poverty, around you know, environmental justice, around this huge growing gap we seem to have as a country and an inability to talk to each other? And how do we not see climate in a box? Because really, the barrier is about bringing those issues together, doing good, and doing right in a way that is only just. And so I think that we have a lot of examples that we can talk about today on our panel about ways in which we've created policy that has gone beyond doing no harm and has taken it further into making sure that we have really great policy. In California, we have tremendous examples of ways in which solar is out there. Solar is in communities that would have been left behind had California not created these policies. But how do we really, as a country, bring those issues together? Because we were talking beforehand, you know, we got some food and we're, you know, kind of talking to ourselves about, well, gosh, you know, this thing needs to happen because, you know, folks need to have a seat at the table, but that intersects with this issue over here and who and where the table is located and how we even think about the technology. And so I think the real barrier is for us not to think of climate in a box, right? And to really push ourselves to think about how do we solve the real issues of our time in a way that they're intersected.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I completely agree. And, you know, I would add to that, why should we look at social justice and climate change in the same, you know, same breath, in the same thread? And part of the reason has to do with the fact that there's an economist out of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, James Boyce, and he's written a paper that says inequality is bad for the environment. This is to say that as long as we continue to have places where we can, you know, sort of hide and put our bad energy policy, and those groups don't have political power, then we're going to continue creating these bad, you know, externality producing types of energy. And so the problem is that you need to give those people a seat at the table. You need to engage them in how the problems should be solved. And a lot of the policies that California would like to put in place as to help us deal with climate change, increased public transportation use, active transportation, affordable housing near transit, all of these strategies are actually things that low-income communities are doing. They are the core of our transit ridership. They are the core of, you know, people who walk. And so what we need to do is they're already doing these things that we consider, you know, good policy. So we need to bring them into the fold so that we can have investments and programs that actually are designed by them, for them, and give them a seat at the table when alternatives are being discussed, when, you know, we need to figure out how to design a program. And so I think that this idea that inequality will continue to produce more pollution, that if we're not thinking about, you know, how to create a rising tide and how to really include these communities, then they're going to be left behind. And the last thing I would say about them being the core of our climate policy has to do with the fact that the oil companies are always talking about low-income communities and how they're going to suffer as a result of these policies. But the fact of the matter is that the evidence has shown that across the nation, people of color are actually more interested in climate justice and clean energy programs than the general population. And in fact, a recent study said that 80% of African Americans surveyed support clean energy policies. So they are ready. They want the state to take action. They want to be involved. And this idea that we should combine climate equity and social equity to create better policy is already happening in California. And I think we can go even further with that. But it is a big blind spot that folks need to turn to.
We're both jumping at the microphone. I just wanted to pick up on one thing, and then I'm going to let you drive, which is just, you know, speaking of what I love about policy is it's just this intersection of philosophy and practicality. Like, how do you take these philosophical concepts and then deliver on them, make them real? So I just want to say, you know, in the initial effort was to try to make solar cheap, and the cheaper it got, the more you saw in the you know, first adopters were people with a lot of money because solar was really expensive. But as solar got cheap, you really saw the demographics change. So in California in 2015, you saw 65% of rooftop solar was installed in zip codes with median household incomes of $70,000 or less. Fresno County has long been a place that's actually been a real solar leader. It's hot, And really half the solar that goes in Fresno County go in zip codes where median household incomes are between $40,000 and $55,000. So as solar gets cheap, it really does become much more distributive. These are also, you know, part of the motivation. Like, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, saving $10, $15, $20 a month on your utility bill is a big deal. It's a real motivating factor to try to do something about that. Where wealthier places, it's not such a motivation. So, yet, you know, that's rooftop solar policy. So, what if you don't own your own roof? What if you're a renter? You know, good 70% of Americans live in places that either have don't own their own roof or their rooftops are shaded. So there are real physical barriers to expanding this ability to access. There are a lot of cost barriers, just access to capital, access to financing. And then, you know, there's a real service gap as well. These are often communities where you've got language barriers, where solar companies aren't used to trying to sell. And so these are, you know, some of the actual barriers that policy needs to address in order to change. And I would love to just hear, you know, you talk about California being a leader. What are some of the things that California has done right? Talk about some of the experiences that really work on the ground.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Solar for All the Planet, and All the People. Adam Browning, Vote Solar. Maybelle Zenzagu, who is climate justice expert, Erica Mackey, co-founder and CEO of Grid Alternatives. So let's go back to Adam's suggestion, and let's hear some more comments. In the meantime, I'll be coming through the audience to pick up audience cards. So if you have an audience question, give it to me so we can get it to Adam. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, I was going to ask a similar question sort of back at us as well, which is, you know, from this framework of like, well, what are some of the models that can be used that, you know, could be scalable, are already scaling? You know, I don't know, Maribel, if you wanted to talk about some of the policies that you helped sort of make happen. And also, you know, maybe we could, Adam, you could do the same. And we could talk about where we've gone right and where we've gone wrong in terms of community engagement and making sure that the policies are actually the right policies to actually get solar for everyone.
Sure, I'll go ahead and begin. So, as I mentioned, in 2006, California passed one of the first climate change solutions bills, and California embarked on this process to deal with climate change. And one of the things that was included in the original bill was a market mechanism for reducing carbon emissions. So essentially, a market mechanism for reducing carbon emissions says, instead of us telling you how much you need to reduce your emissions by, we will set a price on carbon, and then companies, covered entities, you will decide how to deal with it. So what it did is it generated a pot of money for the state, which has become known as the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. And the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund is the money that is generated from the sale of these permits to emit carbon. This was a good policy, except for it was leaving out one thing. If you leave it to the market to decide how to reduce emissions, you're definitely going to get some spots where emissions were reduced a lot and others where they purchased credits and didn't reduce. And the research had shown that when you use these types of market mechanisms, what happens is effectively a race to the bottom, and companies tend to concentrate emissions in areas known as hotspots. So the idea that this carbon program would reduce emissions but would not guarantee that emissions were reduced in disadvantaged areas was a problem for disadvantaged communities across California. So they mobilized and were able to get Kevin De Leon, who's our current Senate president, to author and sponsor a bill called SB 535. What SB 535 does is it says that of all the revenue generated by the state, a certain portion of it has to go to disadvantaged areas. So the state is doing a good job in creating a framework where there's an equity set aside for the most impacted areas. Secondly, the issue was what to do, which programs should receive this money? Exactly how are we going to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in California? And this is where the big equity component came in, because a coalition of folks made up of activists from around the state were able to host community meetings in the communities and say, what is your vision for a just transition for a new economy? And so from that, five priority program areas arose. They were low-income solar, active transportation, urban greening, affordable housing, and that's four. Sorry, I can't remember the fifth one off. So these priorities really came from the communities. They were, as I mentioned before, they're doing these things, they want more. And so we were able to take that to the state and say, these are the community's priorities, and they funded all of those priority program areas. So right now the state is putting millions of dollars into low-income solar, low-income weatherization, active transportation, public transportation, and affordable housing near transit. And the last thing I'll say on that, very sorry, is that we also, that wasn't enough either. We said, you got to do the right programs, but you also have to design them in the right way to make sure that the benefit is flowing to the neediest people. So we did a lot of work with the state of California to come up with a four-step process for analyzing who benefits from an investment and really ensuring that benefits to low-income folks would flow directly, like solar panels on top of their home. Or if they're living in multifamily housing, you know, they can still access that too. So that's some of the work that we've done, and I'm happy to mention anything else, but I want to give it back to my...
I would actually like you to talk about some of the stuff on the ground, the successes that you've seen in a similar way.
Certainly. I mean, there are two large... funding sources to incentivize, for lack of a better word, lower income communities for going solar. And those two sources of dollars are ratepayer dollars administered by the California Public Utility Commission. So ratepayer dollars are the big three investor-owned utilities in California. That money, there's a portion of it that goes into a fund to fund basically solar for both multifamily rental buildings in the affordable housing world and single family homes owned by low income families. And the second source of dollars is the carbon dollars that Maribel was talking about before through what the SB 535 coalition worked on. And those two dollars are able to really change the market in California. And so thousands and thousands of families have gone solar because of those dollars. It's also, enabling weatherization in low-income homes. And I think what's interesting beyond the fact that these families are going solar as part of California's program is that the policy and the way it was implemented is in a way that it really drives job training, you know, a whole house solution to energy for low-income families, and thinks about co-benefits. And so one of the things that was done, not in legislature, but in the way that the program was implemented, was saying, okay, well, this is about real savings. How do we not just think about trading one, you know, traditional electric bill for a solar electric bill of equal amount? How do we really put more money into people's pockets than they had before? How do we think about the co-benefit of energy efficiency? How do we think about the co-benefit of job creation and job training and workforce development? And so I think the way the program has been implemented on the ground has allowed us to do way more than just get solar in lower income communities. And you could think about this, you know, at its worst, what it could have done is put solar on the Walmart that's in a low income community. And I think if you use that as the other example, and it's not that Walmart shouldn't go solar, they absolutely should, and they are. But if you think about how do you really use good policy and good implementation on the ground to lift up communities, then you have to really think about how do you drive this out in a very sort of one rooftop, one person getting a job at a time, and how do you then add that up so that the whole means that we have gone from an industry where at the top of the pyramid we sort of push down with creative financing into the middle class, but we think about what is the base and how do we push up based on need. And I think that California has done that in a really interesting way, and it is starting to get to a place of scale. But let us not be fooled that we haven't gotten to a place where, oh, okay, the problem's solved. You know, people still are struggling with their energy bills. There is still a need for creative technology solutions, like what Adam was talking about, to, you know, serve renters, to serve people who have roofs that are falling down, to serve people living on tribal land with maybe no access to electricity or, you know, sporadic access to electricity. So I think there's a lot that can be done. And there's some really interesting nuances when you go from policy to implementation. There's a lot of things stacked in between. You know, Maribel and I were talking about the CalEnviro screen map, which is this interesting map that overlays poverty with pollution. And it's really what has defined what's a disadvantaged community and where should these dollars be pushed. But it leaves out, for instance, reservations, or it leaves out potentially, you know, some other constituent. And so it really, you know, is great. And like any good program that comes out of policy, needs to still really be thinking about the nuance of who's informing how this works. Did you, Adam, either want to do a question, or did you want to talk about some of the policy stuff yourself, like what you're seeing out of Sacramento in terms of what's coming next?
Yes. thank you for that opportunity, and please let us know when we should switch to the audience questions. Okay. I think we can meld this in all the same, because some of the questions that are being asked are ones that really address this particular concern. So we got a couple of questions talking about this idea of community solar. And so, you know, when you look at California right now, around 30% of Californians are on subsidized energy rates through the CARE program. So all ratepayers are helping essentially lower-income Californians access fossil fuels. And so would like to give a shout out to an audience member here, Joe Weedman, who's been a real leader and a mentor to me on this idea of, like, well, why don't we just take that same dollars that are currently being directed towards, again, providing lower income Californians with fossil fueled power? Why don't we just take that same money and turn it into providing them with solar or renewable power? And so under this concept, the idea is that you would have a community-sized solar project. These other ratepayer funds would go into it, and people would essentially have ownership with a piece of that and get the benefit of what is being produced and have that flow to their bill. That brings up a lot of pretty complex questions from a regulatory policy standpoint. Exactly what should someone be paying for as part of the grid? Exactly what value does that generation in a community-sized solar plant have, and how much should it reduce your particular bill? All of which are solvable, none of which exists in the perfect state anywhere in the country right now. New York, Maryland, Colorado all have, I would say, pilot programs trying to address this. In California, we have, you may have seen it on your electric bill right now, the green tariff shared renewables option. In our view, it doesn't provide as much value as it could or should. In a sense, if you participate, you'll be paying a premium when, in essence, you know, building a new solar plant, you know, it's cheaper than building a new renewable or fossil fuel plant at this point. So I do see great promise going forward around this idea. In fact, my father lives in southwestern Wisconsin, and he's got a there's a electric co-op provides him his power, and he's just participated in a program where, again, they've got a several 100-kilowatt solar system sited in a place that in the community, and he in essence virtually buys 5 panels, and then the generation from that is credited to his bill. So he's got takes advantage of some scale and lower costs, and he doesn't have to deal with maintenance and upkeep and the like. And so that's working very well for him. But again, he's got a co-op where it's membership elected. You know, the management is comes from the community, and they're able to design that. Here in California, I do think we're going to need something different than we have right now, and there are a couple of different policy proceedings that could get us there that are underway at the California Public Utilities Commission as we speak right now. So that is something that I really think provides a solution, a potential solution, because, again, across the country, we are seeing a lot of money that has been, you know, that goes to subsidize fossil fuels. So why not make that something cleaner? There are a couple other questions here that I thought were really good. So one here.
Why don't we take a break right at the moment, Adam, before we start our questions, to remind our audience that this is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is Solar for All the Planet, and All the People. Adam Browning, Vote Solar. Maybell, you have to help me again.
Nzengu,
thank you. Climate justice expert, Erica Mackey, co-founder and CEO and Grid Alternatives. And now we are at the time for our audience and our audience questions. And we have a lot of questions, and they all look very, very good. So let's start, Adam, with your questions. And we were all interested in hearing them and what your panel would suggest for each of the ones that you're asking.
So great question here, referencing a document that Erica and I helped produce called the Low-Income Solar Policy Guide. And the question here was essentially, to whom does this paper pass the torch? By which I take to mean, who is best positioned to lead on implementing, on seeing these policies that provide potential and turning them into actuality? Where does that come from? Is there an organization? Is there, and maybe we can get even larger and more meta there. So I think this would be a great question. You know, how do you see this change happen? Where does the energy come from to change our energy?
That's a great question. And I, like many things in this space, I think it's a both and, right? The answer is yes to whatever the question is. I think when we think about creating policy, and the guide you were referring to is the low-income solar policy guide that was created by Vote Solar, Center for Social Inclusion, and Grid Alternatives, the issue is that states and cities have really been leading in low-income solar policy. And so we wanted to take what has been good examples on the ground and provide a guidebook of options. And it wasn't a one-size-fits-all. It was a, you know, here's some options that you can use in your local market. Because not all markets are California, and not all markets are Colorado, and not all markets are the city of Washington, D.C. And so it's really about, you know, what do you do in Oklahoma that's going to work on the ground, that's going to understand who all of your constituents are and how you're going to take the various levers at your disposal. There is the concept that you put forth, Adam, around community solar, or we all share in this array and we all get benefit even though the array may not be located next to us or on our roof. Or, you know, there is a concept of multifamily. So when you live in an apartment building, how do you have benefit? How does your building owner have benefit? Or the more traditional way we have always, you know, sort of thought of solar is like, it's my rooftop. How do I take back my energy and have panels on my rooftop? And so I think what we tried to provide was this pick list for policymakers that doesn't include you have to implement it in one way. And I think you go from how do you create all these different policies that look at who your constituents are? And then you think about how do you get, what are your goals? What are the co-benefits that you want to do beyond the shiny blue panel and the access? And then how do you take that and implement it in a way that protects your constituents, that lifts up your constituents, that is, you know, doing job creation, that is working with local businesses. And every market is going to have a different way to approach that. And every market is going to, you know, some folks might say, well, what's really important to us is local jobs right here and not taking those jobs outside of this, whatever this is, this region or this city or this state. You know, and everybody is going to have a different way to go about that. And I think the private sector, both the solar industry, small businesses, financing has a huge role to play. The nonprofit sector, which we both represent, has a huge role to play. And local government has a huge role to play. So who's the implementer, right? In some cases, Grid Alternatives has played the role of the implementer. But I don't think we're creating policy that means just our organization is going to be the implementer. If we're creating a movement together, it really has to be we're all the implementer, and it has to be all of our solutions are being put forth.
Maribel, if you have some reactions, just even larger, just on, you know, where does this change come from, and where's the... In the course of your work, and if you'd prefer to go to the next question, we can do that too. So,
I think I'll go for the next question.
All right. I'm going to throw out a little grab bag. One is a technology question. Got several questions on storage. What is the potential for, say, does Tesla and Solar City, the idea of having a battery and a solar panel, make utilities obsolete? How does that change the dynamic? What else should individuals be doing beyond just solar? And I'm also going to throw a little bit, while you guys think about that, there was a couple questions about this, the role of utilities and the power dynamic here. And so as solar has gotten cheaper, it seems that utilities have been pushing back and throwing barriers to individuals being able to generate their own power with solar. And so I'll start with that, which is that is very much the case where we have seen a coordinated effort around the country to make solar less accessible and less value. One, from trying to unwind a policy called net metering, which allows you to get fair value for what you generate and put into the grid. And the other, changing rate structures so that people are paying larger fixed fees when they, not just on a per kilowatt hour basis. So that's a big part of what we're doing to push back. We're also just trying to figure out, you know, a utility, a business model that's based upon not letting customers have what they want is not a good business model. That really does need some improvement. So utilities do provide a valuable service. On one hand, you know, an investment in solar is a private investment for a public good, especially in distributed generation. You're offsetting peak generation costs. You're offsetting the need to build transmission and upgrade distribution systems. And it does have a lot of value that should be recognized. But at the same time, you know, utilities are rather important in the energy field, and allowing them to see their to play a larger role can only accelerate this transition that we're trying to have. So we're at a really interesting time in advocacy where it really has mostly been about creating as much pressure as possible, because that's my view where change comes from. This isn't a white paper war. Change doesn't happen just because you happen to be right. Change happens through pressure, through fighting, and it can get ugly. But that's just the precursor to that happy final place where we get to. So, and I also do think that, you know, this technology, similar to, say, cell phones back in the days of the monopoly of Ma Bell, you could have choice. You get the red phone or the black phone. And it wasn't until you saw that monopoly break up that you then ended up with a situation where, you know, you now have a product where you can access all of human knowledge anywhere in the world at any time, which is better than what Ma Bell was giving you. And in a similar way, you know, this advent of technology storage plus solar solutions will provide that that line-cutting possibility that I think will help drive these business models back towards keeping customers rather than having them cut their line. So there was a lot there that I dove into. If you have your own reflection or your own questions back.
Well, I was wondering if, Maribel, you'd be willing to sort of play off of what Adam was talking about in terms of like how change happens. And, you know, having such a long history in the environmental justice movement, you know, do you have thoughts about what's going to carry us forward into the next decade, and particularly even past November or January, you know, how we see change happening?
Well, I did try to skip that question, but since you've asked, I'll give my two cents. As Adam mentioned, I think no change happens without pressure. And I think one of the things that we've seen over time is, as I mentioned earlier, that the low-income communities are really seeking these energy solutions. And even if the state isn't acting, they're trying to come up with novel ways to get community solar and green their community. And so I think that a lot of the work that I have done as a, you know, policy advocate is to go into the community and talk about these issues and then, you know, really inform them about the legal system and the laws that we have. And, you know, a lot of times community members are not regarded as experts because we have a bias for, you know, a university degree or whatnot. But when it comes to how a policy will impact their community, the community member is the expert. And what we do is take them with us to the policy makers, to the Air Resources Board, to, you know, the Strategic Growth Council, wherever it may be, and show up and share their stories. I have seen that this simple tactic of what I'm talking about, of sharing the stories of impact, can really be powerful when the other folks in the room are, you know, the oil industry or folks that are pushing back. And so we really want to give the policymakers like a good reason to support low-income communities. And they're not going to do that on their own. They have to be pushed. And the folks need to get to the table with informed ideas, not just general, but like how can they engage the process and really bring more people into the process so that we're seeing more policy suggestions coming up from the ground up. So that's my theory of change, that no change happens without organizing the people on the bottom to really press on the people at the top.
And I just want to speak to the efficacy of that. I mean, right now we work around the country, but in California right now, you know, the strongest caucus in Sacramento is the Latino caucus. And if you haven't thought through these equity issues in an energy bill and you're trying to get it through leadership there with Senator Kevin De Leon, like it's just... not going to get as good a reception. This really matters to him and to other leaders in Sacramento. And that really, as demographic change happens, as effective organizing happens, as wins on the ground happen, that's reflected really in the political leadership. And I really think California is a postcard from the future. Like, we're going to see this kind of change happening in other states as well. It does happen in other states as well, but California just is a little bit farther ahead.
I mean, one of the exciting things about clean tech and the solar industry in particular is that the industry is adding growth and jobs at a tremendous rate. And so we have this real potential to create a different look of who is the solar industry and who is the energy industry. And I think that's already happening. As someone who works on workforce development and is really focused on the pipeline of people into the solar industry, I think we are going to see change happen because there's going to be a groundswell in our companies, right? I think our companies, hopefully, if we do this right, are going to be a new kind of company. And when you have a more inclusive, a more diverse, a more equitable company, and that's sort of the dream that I have for the solar industry, I think then you create different kinds of solutions. My hope is that we will create a different company that then drives different results in a much more equitable way.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to our program, Solar for All the Planet, and All the People. We're coming near to the end of our program tonight, and we did have one question that did come in. Let me see if I can say this correctly. Actually, it seems to me to be an important question. How do we transition workers and families in those areas of oil, gas, and coal, that's the thing. When they have to transition into new areas of work and jobs, and even change communities, and I think it's social connections. In other words, as these particular areas may go down in terms of productivity, what's going to happen to the people on the ground who've been in these communities working hard at very difficult jobs? How are they going to survive? Does that make sense to you?
It does, and I think that's a great question.
I think what we need to do is, again, not put climate in a box. right? That jobs and the opportunity to create transition jobs for folks is very real in the new clean economy. And it's about how do we then create the mechanisms that drive that job growth and that job training or workforce development for communities that need that. And so, you know, where our policies are driven in terms of what jobs will be ending and what jobs are being created, it means that we need to be driving for more good, clean economy in all of our states, right? Not just in, you know, states that have readily, you know, policymakers that are willing to adopt these, you know, good RPS goals or whatever. So I think it's really about thinking through the policy and the mechanisms and saying, okay, well, we want more clean power, and this is the way we are going to mandate that our community gets those jobs and that our community gets those, you know, training opportunities. I don't know. Maribel, do either of you have better,
no,
better solutions?
I think you're right on. The issue, you know, there are far more solar workers in this country right now than there are coal miners. But there really is a geographic inequity here, you know, where you've got coal miners focused heavily in West Virginia. There's not much solar in West Virginia. But that's actually easily remedied. If West Virginians want to have good solar economy, they just need to pass policies that help drive solar. It's as easy as that. It's an on-off switch. I say that, and that is comes across a little bit glib. This is a difficult transition. These are skills, and people are not fungible. They just can't go from one place to another place and just plug them in. And it's, you know, this is an issue that's not just faced with the transition from fossil fuels to renewable energy, as has been heavily discussed in this presidential election season. There have been a lot of winners and a lot of losers from just globalization and trade in general. These are hard questions without a real investment in social safety nets to really solve. So,
And it hasn't gotten direct funding yet, but we've been working at the state level to get the Air Resources Board and other implementing agencies to see workforce development and training and apprenticeship as a valid use of these greenhouse gas reduction dollars. Because again, if we are going to invest to benefit disadvantaged communities, one of the most meaningful ways to benefit them is through this just transition to the clean economy. And so I would say that continuing to work for that and push for that at the state level to get some more state dollars directed to workforce development is a very key thing. But I would also lift up how Erica and Grid Alternatives are doing their work and getting money from the state, but they're already incorporating workforce development into how they do their work. And so seeing more of that and more dedicated dollars, I think, is one of the key things that we need to turn to now.
So, Maribel, in what you're talking about, it's somewhat related, I think, in this question is what you're talking about, job development and job training for those people who have to make the transition. Are you aware of any kind of in efforts to begin to look at real job training and job transitions? Because it seems to, in terms of this writer, it seems to me that that's what one of the real hurdles is not to leave people in poverty without giving them an avenue to new jobs or new skills.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, I think that is a key component for us of good low-income solar policy, that job training and workforce development has to be a core part of what we look at. And so, I mean, I can only speak to our work specifically, and we are not working in West Virginia, but, you know, everything we do that uses any kind of dollar, be that private, philanthropic, or government, has a workforce development element to it. So people are getting real hands-on experience and training and real, you know, placement opportunities to get jobs in the industry. For example, you know, Grid Alternatives subs out some of our work. And for any subcontractor that works with us, they must hire a job trainee on that job as a paid in-the-field interview. And 65% of our subcontractors said after they were forced to hire Susie or Bobby, they hired them on full time because they saw that they were great at bending conduit or they were great at installing panels.
Adam, would you like to comment on that?
Actually, I think Erica and Maribel answered well. So.
Oh, great. Well, this is Ann Clark at the Commonwealth Club, and you have been listening to the to our program tonight on Solar for All and All the Planet and All the People. We have reached just about the end of our program tonight, and I want to remind you that we really appreciate your being here. And first of all, we want to really thank our panel tonight. This has been an excellent panel, and we're really happy that they were here. And we're talking to Adam Browning, who is Vote Solar, and actually helped us begin to think about this and get this program happening tonight. So thank you very much, Adam. And Maybelle Nzagu, is that right? Did I get it right? Not quite. Climate justice expert who came tonight on really the last moment and joined us, and she's given us so much wonderful information and viewpoints. So thank you very much, Maybelle, for being here. We really, really appreciate it. And for Erica Mackey, the co-founder and CEO for Grid Alternatives, your experience and your practicality and how you've presented it to us all tonight has really been excellent. So let's give our panel a huge round of applause. So many thanks to our wonderful audience here. We really appreciate your being here. And all our audiences on the radio and the internet. Find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. You can click on our website for Watch and Listen, our multimedia access to programs, current news feeds, streaming audio, radio schedules, 230 radio stations on national radio networks, and also find audio and videotapes and free weekly podcasts and archived programs. Tonight's program was also sponsored by the member-led forums, Science and Technology. Their chair is Gerald Harris, and we thank Gerald. And Business and Leadership, Kevin O'Malley chair, both who really very much were excited about the program we had tonight on solar. So follow us on the Commonwealth Club website and the magazine for our fall 2016 environmental programs. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.